we were absolute rivals, absolutely at each other's throats. Some BBC producer said I was nothing better than a baked bean salesman. I'm a pretty aggressive person in terms of my ambition. I'm probably cocky.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moments series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Phil Riley.
My mother got pregnant when she was 24 in Dublin. She wanted to keep the child, but she didn't want to get married. That was a real problem. She came across on the boat to Manchester, got a job working as a hat check girl in the clubs in Manchester, Oxford Road. A couple of weeks before she gave birth, she stopped working. She had me. Within a few days, the social services came around and said, we're going to have to take this child off you, Miss Kinsella. You're not allowed to have a child as an unmarried mother. I mean, it's quite remarkable to say that now. And she said, I'm going to take this child home to its grandparents and they're going to look after him while I come back here and work. My mum got out of the hospital bed, wrapped me up in swaddling or whatever you did in those days, and went back to Liverpool, got on the boat, got back to Dublin, took me back to my grandparents' house. She went back to Manchester, came back to see me every couple of weeks, managed to find a fella that she fell in love with, and he fell in love with her. Look, I come with some baggage here. There's a child back in Dublin. He didn't appear to bat an eyelid to that, and they came over to Dublin and met my grandparents and the rest of my mum's family, and they all took to my dad, Jim. My mum and dad got married and went through a sort of formal adoption process so dad could be formally on the birth certificate as my father. They then came and took me away from Dublin and took me back to Manchester. I didn't find out about this until I was 10 or 11, rooting around in my parents' bedroom during the summer holidays, found some papers, started investigating the papers, discovered two birth certificates with different names on them, you know, scratched my head as a 10 or 11-year-old trying to figure out how this worked. I had a number of conversations with my mum about it when I was grown up. They gave me an absolutely brilliant, loving upbringing, and I'm so proud of my mum to have the determination, the nerve to go against everything that society tells you. Marvellous thing. I could have ended up, I mean, you see the stories now, there's the Philomena film, and there's stories of kids in the late 50s and early 60s who were born out of wedlock in Dublin and ended up in care homes and were horribly abused, and God, you know, I was saved from that by a bloody determined woman. I mean, I still can't watch that film, the Philomena. I can't bring myself to watch it.
I only want to know if he's all right.
Perhaps these older nuns could help us with some of the details.
So I was pretty clever but didn't work that hard. Always more mathematically, scientifically orientated kid at school. Those are the things that I did best at. So that analytical skill definitely was there from the outset. I'd like to think it was combined to a degree with some creativity. I certainly enjoyed being on stage. That was something I remember very clearly from school, was participating in the school theatrical productions and being part of those and being on stage. That was definitely something that floated my boat. And I was really into music from back end of the Motown era. So we're talking Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye. I had been bought a radio for Christmas by my parents, and I remember thinking this was such a fantastic gift to have been bought that it couldn't have been bought for me, and it had been left accidentally in my bedroom, and going saying, somebody's left a radio in my bedroom. And it was one of those old Philips transistor radios. This must have been 65, 66, I guess, and I would have listened to that under the bed sheets at night. My radio recollections don't really start until 9 or 10. I remember being with my uncle, who was a delivery man. It was Easter holidays and my parents went out to work. They sort of handed me over to my uncle and I just went on his delivery route with him round the northwest. And it was Easter and Radio 1 were playing the top 200 of all time. This is 1970, so there weren't that many records to go in the top 200 of all time. And I remember the Beatles getting four of the top five songs. and being quite amazed because I was probably slightly late to develop, and I didn't realise the Beatles were as big as they were until that time, and that was about 1970.
Welcome to the first programme of the new year, or as they say in Iceland, welcome to the first programme of the new year. 1972 sees no changes.
Strong memories of Radio 1 with Noel Edmonds doing the breakfast show. He was the guy for me that cemented that style of being a great personality breakfast show host, and then Piccadilly coming along. So it was the Radio 1 of Noel Edmonds, which I guess was 72, 73, and then Piccadilly with Roger and Phil Wood and the rest of the guys, and that was probably Piccadilly that drove me to think, wow, this what a great thing this would be to get a career doing this.
Ah, there it is. That's Olivia Newton-John, our entry in the Eurovision Song Contest, and I think it's going to be the winner. And that's Long Live a Love here on 261. Look out for Overnight Mist on the Hills. Going to disperse during the morning. Sunny spells this afternoon.
All of the universities I applied to had university radio stations. I had already made up my mind that I really wanted to get into radio and try and find a way. Before I'd gone to university, I'd managed to get a little bit of work experience, only like a half day or a day at BBC Radio Manchester. And I was besotten with the industry. I definitely thought, this is what I want to do. So Loughborough, Reading, can't remember the other ones now, but I know that they all had university radio stations. And my parents were a bit disappointed. They wanted me to go to Manchester University because it was on the doorstep and I could live at home and it would be less expensive, etc. But I was determined to go away. Loughborough offered me the best course for me, and I actually, the course I did was computer studies. I mean, it bears no relation to what computers are today. It was, you know, computers were in rooms, glassed off rooms, and you handed your program into some chap in a white lab coat and he took it away and brought it back an hour later. So it was an entirely different subject to what it is today. And it was at a time when computer studies department was essentially an offshoot of the maths department, which suited me fine. I enjoyed writing programs. It's a very logical thing to do, and that suited the way my brain worked. The good thing about that particular subject was, if you were any good at it, which I was, you could do it quite quickly. It wasn't like doing history or English lit, where no matter how brilliant you were, you still had to write the damn essay, and that took you forever. In computing, if you could get your code right and put it in quickly and it worked, you were done. So it was the perfect course for me. I could spend all my time being involved in the university radio station. I ended up being the program controller in my second year there, and then ended up as the station manager in my third year. I applied to the BBC for a studio manager, studio assistant job, didn't get that. I think I made some terrible remark about the London bias of the Today programme on Radio 4. That didn't go down well. 30, 40 years later, it could probably still be made. Then I applied to Pennine, one or two other places that I knew were looking for people. At that time, this is 1980, as the commercial radio industry became profitable, the IBA introduced this concept of secondary rental, which essentially said, if you're going to make a huge profit, that's not right because you're sitting on airwaves that the government have lent you, so we're going to charge you more rental for that. The only way to avoid paying us more of that money is to pay it out yourself in certain prescribed ways to worthy causes. So one of the things that Capital did, for example, would be the Wren Orchestra. BR&B did a very similar thing. They sponsored the CBSO. And one of the other things that most of the big companies did was to start up training schemes. BR&B decided to put their money into hiring four trainees, and I applied for one of those program trainee jobs. I think there were about 700 people applied for these jobs. So it was I did pretty well, and it was a very satisfactory conclusion. It wasn't just being a gopher, it was really learning the trade and learning all there was to know about radio from the inside in a big station where there were a lot of very talented and clever people.
Memo to those with nothing to do tonight, how about coming down to the Locarno to a charity disco? I'm performing, and so is BR&B's John Slater. And as an engineer, he makes a great disc jockey. We'll be down there tonight. It's all proceeds are going to the Yardley Playbus Association. And for those people who use their facilities, we'd like to see you there.
When it's cold, BR&B in 1980, again, had been going 6 years. Really was at its peak, I would say, in terms of its popularity. Had big personalities all the way through the schedule. So you had Les Ross doing breakfasts. I still think one of the top two or three breakfast presenters I think we've ever had in this country. You had Ed Doolan as the talk guy. Roger Day had moved to BR&B by then and was doing Drive Time. You had Nicky Steele, Brendan Kearney. The legendary Tony Butler was doing sport. The newsroom was chock full of people who went on to have careers elsewhere. Many people high up in the BBC today in news started their lives in BR&B or worked through BR&B on their way through. Brian Shepherd was the news editor, and I think everybody recognised that he was a real doyen of the business, and if you wanted to learn, he was the guy to go and learn from.
It's 6 o'clock. Good morning. This is Brian Shepherd with BR&B Sound News.
Building was the old ATV Studios Radio House on Aston Road North. My first memory of turning up for my interview was getting out of the cab. I travelled by train to New Street, got a cab to the building. I remember getting out of the cab and being overwhelmed by the smell of HP Source, because the HP Source Works was literally across the road from the building, and on a Thursday they did the melding and the mixing of the source, and the smell was, wow, just absolutely knocked you out. I remember thinking, how could anybody live with this smell?
The Laurie Bauer Singers and You Don't Bring Me Flowers. I noticed Mike was talking earlier on, if you were listening to him, about 2:30, about sunflower power. And it's interesting because...
The first overnight show, I believe there's still a tape of it, embarrassing, as all first shows are. I managed to get through it. I thought, OK. And then I remember going down and said to the security guard, this is about 6:30 as I was leaving the building, I said, that was all right, wasn't it? And the security guard said, yeah, apart from the bit where you left the mic open for 30 between 4 and 4:30. So... It was overnight. It was tremendously exciting. I mean, what a thing to do, to be on a real radio station talking to real people, even though it was in the middle of the night. There were clearly people listening, and the phone lines were going.
That is nice. Steve Winwood from the album Ark of a Driver and Second Hand Woman, and you'll be hearing a lot of that album here on BR&B.
And our managing director was a lovely old chap called David Pinnell. A British guy, but had spent a great part of his career in South Africa running commercial radio down there. Nice guy. He'd gone back to South Africa and had seen this idea for a marketing gizmo, which was essentially a baseball cap that allowed you to listen to the radio station. He didn't bring one back, but he wanted to describe what it looked like. So he managed to find a baseball cap and a pair of headphones and a 12-inch ruler, and taped the ruler to the baseball cap to replicate what an aerial would look like, and then put these headphones on and walked around the building with this pair of headphones and a baseball cap and a ruler sticking out of his head. And this guy, he must have been 65 at the time, and he was saying, this will be the biggest, most brilliant marketing thing we've ever done. And absolutely everybody looking at him thinking, that man's gone mad. So I'm doing lots of bits and pieces on air, doing the occasional shift. We get to the end of the year and it's one of those up or out. And Bob decides it's going to be up, and he asks me if I want to do 2 till 4 in the afternoon. And one of the interesting things was that was going to be slot in the day for doing interviews. And that was a great thing for me. You know, I had a great time interviewing anybody and everybody that came through, certainly all the showbiz people. So that was a great thing. And I still have some very antiquated black and white pictures of me in the early 80s interviewing the Bee Gees and Gladys Knight and the Pips and people like that. So that was fun. I think I gradually came to the conclusion that I was pretty good at radio, but that particular thing of being, you know, one of the three or four main daytime people probably wasn't my forte, and I should start to look to do something else if I wanted to really make a career for myself in the business.
You've been listening to 60 Years of Radio. The programme was produced by David Gilby and Dennis Rookard.
This was still a time, early 80s, when commercial radio had a lot of speech. I got asked if I wanted to become the station's talks and features producer, doing lots of interviews, producing features. That was great. That was an entirely new set of skills that I managed to learn. We used to have a regular weekly programmes meeting. Bob would chair it as the programme director. Mike Owen would be in there as his deputy. We had a community events organiser who would be in there. Robin Valkin as the head of music. We had somebody else in doing something else. I was in there as a talks and features producer. And I remember thinking, blimmin' heck, there's a lot of people I've got to get past to get into Bob's chair. My ambition was to become a manager, a proper manager. I decided to go and do an MBA. Radio was great. I loved it. It was a fantastic business to be in, but I wasn't earning a great deal of money. I think I was earning £8,000-9,000 a year at the time, and this is 1984-85. So I decided I was going to go and do an MBA. I'd also had an abiding love of America, and I decided, well, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, I wonder if I could do an MBA in America. And I have to be honest, looking back, that was the most ridiculous thing I ever thought, but I had a crack at it and I applied to everywhere I could and was very, very fortunate to end up being offered a place at Columbia in New York, which is one of the world's top 10 business schools. And I probably at the time, I have to be honest, thought I was going to leave radio and I was going to do an MBA and I might end up as a management consultant or as an investment banker. But whilst at Columbia, I did a lot of project work, which ended up, unsurprisingly, back around radio. I was in New York, which was the world epicentre for radio at the time. It was where Scott Shannon was. It was where Don Imus was.
I hate those scary intros. 8:47. Well, coming up on 8:48, 12 till 9 o'clock, WNBC Radio New York.
Big brands, millions of dollars on promotion, huge fight between different radio stations, and I got really excited about all of that and did some of my MBA coursework studying what was going on in US radio. But again, the timing was very fortunate because just as I was finishing my MBA, getting back into radio at a time when it was really just about to expand.
Les Ross and BRMB. Lovely sunny Monday morning here in Austin. I don't know what we've done to deserve it. Nichelle's is...
Commercial radio was all about getting itself noticed, getting on the map. And the big stations did that quite successfully. We did enter a period, didn't we, from 80 through to 85, when we launched another tranche of stations, some of which weren't as successful as the earlier ones. It could be frequency issues or the wrong patch or whatever. So I think by the time you get to the mid-80s, there are definitely problems in commercial radio. Behind the scenes at managing director level around the industry, there was great disquiet with the way the IBA worked and how prescriptive they were and how demanding they were. And this all boiled over, didn't it, into a whole bunch of meetings and confrontations between the industry and the regulator. I remember going for the first public meeting for the first renewal of BRMB's licence, and what a palaver that was. You know, I did remember coming out of that thinking, crikey, this is a lot of hoops you've got to jump through here to keep your licence. That may have been part subliminally of why I thought maybe I should go off and do something else. And interestingly, I think I came back to a changed environment, and that environment probably was changing whilst I was away. I had this brilliant idea. So sometimes I have a brilliant idea that pays off, and I'm grateful for those. And then sometimes I have a brilliant idea that doesn't pay off. Hopefully you learn more from the brilliant ideas that don't pay off. So I had this idea to start up a syndication company, and I'd seen them work in the States. And in fact, I think one of the projects I'd done in my MBA was about syndication. This is making short form features and monetizing them. And obviously I'd been making short form features before I'd gone to do my MBA. So I thought, well, I know what I'm doing here. But I couldn't sell the ad space, so that was very frustrating. Ian Rufus, who by then had become the managing director of BRMB, lent me an office inside BRMB to do this at a peppercorn rent, £10 a month or something. And I remember going into his office and saying, this isn't working, thanks very much for the loan of the office. I've been made a job offer by, it was KPMG actually, and it was a well-paid job. And I needed some money because I'd come back from Columbia and had spent 6 months trying to start this business and couldn't get it going. And he said, well, don't take that job. He said, I've got a job for you. We've been a bit late. He said, BRMB and Mercy have merged. He said, we've been a bit late in launching our AM. And the rule at the time from the IBA was, use it or lose it. They said to all the radio stations that had the same programming on FM and AM, you've got to do something different on both, otherwise we're going to take one of them off you. Ian said to me, how do you fancy launching the new AM service? Now, that was for somebody that had never been a programme director before, had never launched anything before. That was a fantastic opportunity, and that was a great show of faith in me by Ian. That was the start of a, you know, hugely fun time launching that radio station and going on and doing other launches. But Extra was the first and was very memorable for a number of reasons.
I'm Phil Riley. Stay tuned to this frequency because something extra is happening at 8 o'clock this morning.
If you only have two signals in a market, two stations, the obvious split is to say we're going to make one of them younger and one of them older. Whether older has to be oldies is the first question, and whether younger has to be constantly top 40 is the second question. And arguably, in a more sophisticated environment in which we're now in, we know that on FM you can appeal to a young audience without necessarily being massively contemporary all the time, although when you've got 10 signals in a market, you maybe do need to be a bit more careful about what you do. I think the other element to this was one was on FM and one was on AM, and there was a natural belief at the time that there were more listeners on AM, but they were older. Interestingly, I can't recall us ever doing any massively detailed background research on the demographic profile of FM versus AM. I'm sure we did, but I can't recall the data. I'm not sure there was a terrible mistake there, but not everybody got it right. And just in terms of your base audience, if there are more people listening on one platform than another just because the signal's better, you're going to do better when you launch a new service on it.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 4th of April, 1989. I'm Les Ross. Welcome to XTRA Extra AM. Now, that's the cue for the champagne corks to pop in the boardroom. Go, well, they've stopped listening.
My view was oldies were the obvious untapped major opportunity, and certainly if you went to the States at the time, many of the biggest stations in the major markets were oldie stations. It was backed up by some research, and again, this was something that I brought back from the States and having seen it over there when I'd been in the radio stations doing this MBA research, and they'd been telling me about how very carefully they researched their music. I thought, well, we should do the same here, and that was when I first hooked up with Rachel Steele, who runs Questionnaire. So this is back in 88, and we did some of the very first, if not the first, music testing in the UK, and we did it in a upstairs room in a pub in Yardley in Birmingham, and we got 100 people in the room, gave them a pint, piece of paper and a pencil, and played them the hooks of 350 songs. Rachel went away and shoved it all in the computer and came back and said, right, you can play this song, but don't, whatever you do, play that song. And that was how we did the original music research. It went down well with some people who thought, wow, that's really interesting. You know, we need to do more of this. We need to be a bit more professional and scientific. It went down very badly with others. I can remember going to my first radio conference in 1990 and talking about this on stage. Some BBC producer stood up and said I was nothing better than a baked bean salesman. Well, it still stuck with me even today, and this is, we're almost 30 years on, so I can tell you how cutting I felt it was at the time. And that was because at the time, the business was run almost entirely on gut and intuition, and anybody that came up with a sort of more logical way of doing things or proposed something that was scientific, you know, was poo-pooed, really. At the same time, there were plenty of people out there who were really interested in it. In fact, I sold it to the Transworld Group. I can remember the very erudite Len Grote saying that one of the things that wouldn't work in the East Midlands was programming hot chocolate as a out-of-hour opener, because it never was that popular in the East Midlands. And I'd got research which showed it was tremendously popular in the West Midlands. And I'm not sure Len had got the research to prove his point, but that was the way things were at that point. People who felt they were intuitively great at programming held great sway in the industry, and those of us who said, well, maybe we should research that, there were fewer of us. But over time, it's become much more the case that you need to demonstrate the veracity of your argument. Extra was a phenomenon. It launched extremely well, helped undoubtedly by the fact that it had Les Ross at breakfast. And I think that was part of the challenge for Mike Owen programming the FM station was Les was undoubtedly of older appeal. And if Mike was to launch a station or relaunch BR&B or refresh BR&B to make it appealing to young people, was Les the right person to do that? And I think Mike took a view that maybe he would have a go at a newer, fresher team. I think we had a 20, I'm tempted to say 26% weekly reach at one point, maybe two or three surveys in, which for an AM station, when you think about it now, is just absolutely phenomenal. I got poached to go to Leeds to turn around Radio Air and launch their AM service. They hadn't launched, so they were under a bit of pressure to do that.
It's 8:28 across West Yorkshire, and it's here. The all-time great music station, Magic 828.
Interesting 4 years because it was 1990 to 94, and 1990 and 1991 were two awful years for the economy. It was a huge depression. Ad revenues dropped by 15% in 1990, and then they dropped by another 15% in 1991. So we were about 30% down by the end of my first 2 years there. Not the greatest of backgrounds to try and launch a new radio station, but we did it and we had a great time, and there were a bunch of very good people there. Lots of talent around. Ray Stroud, Peter Tate, Chris Moyles was there, just sort of starting out his career.
Well, I'm sorry about this, but I'm back on the air again, and we have some great love prizes for you tonight. If you're in love with somebody and you're wild about them, you can always call us up anytime tonight. We'll play you a tune.
Lots of very talented people, good newsroom. The constant frustration was that the frequency, the FM frequency, wasn't very good. We tried and tried to get the IBA to let us go on to the Emily transmitter, because that would have solved so many problems. But at the time, they were absolutely insistent that we couldn't broadcast to more than just Leeds. They didn't want us broadcasting into anywhere else, and therefore being on Emily would have been too powerful a transmitter. Massively frustrating that we couldn't do that. So that was the downside. And I think even today, when you look at radio, when you look at Air FM's numbers, they're hampered by that FM frequency not being as powerful as it could be. The latter 2 years, the revenue roared back in 92, 93, 94. At the point I left, we were just about to announce Radio Air's first ever profit, which was phenomenal considering the station had launched in the early 80s and had gone through year after year of terrible problems, terrible results. That was very pleasant. I had a good time there. We got married while I lived up in Radio Air, had my first child, born at Leeds General Infirmary. So, you know, lots of good things happened to me and I had a good time and it was enjoyable, although Transworld, the group, was a challenging group to work for, and Owen was a challenging boss, Owen Oyston. There was lots of politics. I think that was a distraction for those of us, people like me and John Myers, and the other guys who just wanted to run the radio stations. There was an awful lot of stuff happening in the boardroom which managed to get in the way. But you've got to take the rough with the smooth when you're at that position in a radio group.
Good morning. My name is Owen Oyston, the chairman of Red Rose Radio, Lancashire's first independent local radio station.
I think I learned a lot, and I think I learned more in my first few years at Radio Air than I probably have learned since. You make more mistakes early on. I don't think I'd ever had a problem being a programme director manager, because you're dealing essentially with a single class of individuals, a single group of people who you tend to have a common focus. I'm not saying that they all agree with each other and that there isn't rivalry between them, but they all have the same sort of mindset. They're all thinking the same way, and therefore managing them requires a certain type of skill. When you become a general manager and you're not only managing a bunch of programmers, but you're managing a bunch of recalcitrant journalists, bonus-hungry salespeople, awkward engineers, admin people who feel they've been overlooked, I'm applying cliches there to people, but suddenly you discover that actually the world isn't full of people who think like programmers and presenters think. It's full of other people. And that really was an eye-opener. And that was a big learning experience to figure out, actually, I need to manage this person entirely differently to the way that I manage somebody else. So I ended up falling out with a lot of people in Leeds as a result of me not being the best manager I could be and wanting to get stuff done and not take some people with me. So, yeah, I learned a lot, and hopefully I'm the better manager for it now. Again, it was just at the time when 93, 94, we were starting to see the big regionals being advertised. I was a brown envelope candidate for one of the London licences, which must have been in 92, early 93, alongside Paul Smith's company, Celador. And I was in the brown envelope as the managing director, and it was a rock application for London called The River, which would have been great had we won it, but we didn't. So I was obviously itching to move on, I think, at that point. And then the regional licence for the West Midlands was awarded to Chrysalis, and I was offered that job in 1994. Moved back to Birmingham in April, which suited me down to the ground because I love the city and the region. Suited my wife down to the ground. We were expecting another child. I was taking a risk and a punt, I suppose, because Chrysalis had got no on-the-ground expertise. They owned a bit of Metro, and Richard Huntingford had learned a bit from doing that, but his background wasn't in radio, and they'd got Charles Levinson on the board, who'd been an advisor to Richard Branson, so had done a bit of radio and in being on the board at Virgin. But there were no hands-on radio people inside Chrysalis, so I was the first, and it was, you know, what a ride. It was fantastic. We knew we had to get on air in September, and I started in April, and that was fantastic because that really was an absolutely green field. Crikey, we haven't got an office, we haven't got a phone, we haven't got a phone number, we haven't got anything. How are we going to get on air in 5 months?
You're listening to Test Transmissions from Heart FM, the new soft rock station for Warwickshire and the West Midlands.
I'm a pretty aggressive person in terms of my ambition. I'm an ambitious person, probably cocky, and I never thought we couldn't do it. It was just we were doing it on a very tight time frame, and I suppose what was going through my mind was, can I juggle all of these pieces, get all of the jigsaw pieces in the right place in order to hit that early September? There was another critical piece to this, that the London license bid, which was going in that summer, which I then was also helping Richard to write, was going to be decided in the middle of October. We knew that our best shot at winning the London licence was to have launched and been successful in Birmingham. There was an awful lot of pressure. I loved the pressure, but it was a big challenge to find the building and get it built. And we cut some corners and skin of our teeth time in lots of things. And those people who are around in the run-up to the launch will remember the calamity that was the original playout system. It was the original RCS master control, and it collapsed on us the weekend before we launched. I mean, it literally died a death on the Friday. In fact, Nick Piercy was doing who was doing Drive, was doing a Friday afternoon rehearsal, his last one before we packed up for the weekend, and the system suddenly died. And this was maybe 5:30, 6 o'clock on the Friday night. We all rushed into the studio, couldn't figure out what had gone wrong, and none of us were particularly, even though I'd got a degree in computing, I certainly didn't know how to fix this. We called RCS, and the guy at RCS said, I don't know how to fix it, and they called New York, and some guy from New York literally got on a plane, flew over. Whilst the guy was in the air, Alan Carruthers, who was my number two, and I said, we're going to have to figure out a backup here, because if we can't get the playout system to work, we've got to launch on Tuesday. We're launching on Tuesday. So we spent that weekend putting CDs on mini discs, getting a mini disc system plugged in. The engineer came in, he found out what was wrong. It was a corrupted hard drive. He repaired the hard drive. We reloaded everything because it had corrupted everything. So there was, it was absolute bedlam and panic. And then on the Monday evening, we had a pre-launch dinner at the Hyatt, Regency Hyatt. And all the bigwigs from Chrysalis were there. Chris Wright was there. George Martin, who was on the board of Chrysalis, the Beatles producer and mayor of Birmingham, etc. We had this big launch dinner. Meantime, Alan's back at the building making sure that it's not going to collapse again. And we got everything was fine, and there was a launch party and the champagne and everybody cheering them. and then by 10:30 it crashed again.
Stand by, everybody. We're on air in 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6.
We did a mini dip survey literally 2 weeks after we launched, and it was pretty good. 9% reach. And we widely promoted that. We certainly promoted the fact that it was something like 15%, 25 to 44s, whatever it was that we were targeting, and made sure the IBA knew that. We invited up the Director General of the IBA, Sir Peter Baldwin, to open the building and to unveil the plaque. We were trying to do everything we could to get into the IBA's good graces before they made that decision on the London licence. And, of course, they did that about 6 or 7 weeks after we launched. And we won London too. So that was fantastic. And that really cemented radio at the heart of Chrysalis for the next 12, 13 years. 100.7 Heart FM. Heart initially was, we built it as soft rock. It sort of morphed pretty quickly, I think, into adult contemporary. And we lost some of the softer rock stuff that wasn't that popular and replaced it with slightly more popular stuff. We did the research, and the research told us which direction to go into. Always massively ambitious. I was determined that our goal was to knock BR&B off the top spot in Birmingham, and then when we won the London licence, it was obviously to knock Capital off the top spot in London. That was a challenge that took us 3, 4, 5 years in Birmingham. Slightly easier in Birmingham to get to some degree bigger than BR&B, simply because we covered a bigger footprint, so we could claim a bigger reach earlier, even though in the Birmingham market itself we might have been behind. We could claim more listeners, and so we were going out claiming to be number one, even though BR&B would come back and say, no, hang on a second, we've got bigger audiences in Birmingham. In London, of course, it was absolutely the same footprint. That took longer, but we did it. 2001, I think, was the first time that we managed to beat Capital in reach and or share. We certainly at one point were beating them in both. So we were absolutely ambitious right from the start. And I should say, the guys inside Capital and BR&B, who of course it was one company at the time, were equally ambitious to not let us do that. That was a pretty big fight that was going on between the Chrysalis crowd and the Capital crowd. And David Mansfield, who's now one of my best mates, David and I and Richard Park, you know, we were absolute rivals, absolutely at each other's throats in a good way. There was a bit of nastiness around the edges, but nothing that you wouldn't expect in a commercial fistfight. It was great times. And I think the radio industry was the better for that level of competition between players. And it certainly happened in our market, and it happened elsewhere up and down the country. You know, John Myers, Metro and Century was the same sort of thing. Kept everybody on their toes.
8 minutes past seven on London's new Heart 106.2. Oh, we're still sipping the champagne. Outside the studio, there's a whole gang of people there sipping champagne at this
time. We were lucky to win two licences. I mean, without having won both of those Heart licences, whether Chrysalis would have backed radio to the extent it did, I don't know. But they did, and Richard got the nod as the sort of chief exec of the division with me as the MD, and he was essentially given the brief to go and buy Chrysalis's way to the top table, which is what he did brilliantly. And we went and bought Galaxy in Bristol, kept the brand, kept the format, and then used that when we bought the two KISS stations in Manchester and Yorkshire shortly afterwards. And we used the Galaxy brand. We couldn't use the KISS brand. KISS was owned by EMAP at the time. They were more than happy for a small indie to use their brand, but they didn't want a big rival like Chrysalis to use their brand, so we had to go with something else. I think we were expecting a more drawn-out, pleasant handover than actually was the case. It was rather challenging. We bought the business, and we were told in no uncertain terms by Tim Shoemaker, pay us a fortune or you stop using the brand, and you better stop using it in the next couple of weeks because that's what the brand license says. After Tim left the room, Richard and I looked at each other and said, well, we've got 2 weeks then. So Steve Parkinson will tell the story about how frantically we did have to do that brand change. And that was difficult because there were people up there in Leeds and Manchester who absolutely loved the KISS brand, and you can understand why. It was a fabulous brand. But we couldn't use it, and we had to change it, and they felt Galaxy was an inferior brand, and that was a bit of a a hearts and minds thing to persuade them, but actually, we did a great job with Galaxy.
Ah, dear me, dear me, dear me. Good morning, it's 6.02, number one for Dance and R&B. This is Galaxy 105. Good morning from Hursty. This,
in particular, in Yorkshire, it became the most monumental radio station. Pretty soon, I think that it's terrible we've lost Kiss. I think that was forgotten about because Galaxy was so popular and we had such a great time with it. It was a intensive music station, so it didn't cost a massive amount to run. You weren't paying for hugely expensive personality presenters, although the presenters we got were great personalities. We'd never felt we needed a Les Ross type character to come on in a local market to do well because we felt the music would make the difference. The challenge, I think, was that because it was a young station and aimed at people under the age of 30, local advertisers tended to be second or third on their choice. So you wouldn't get the double glazing manufacturers, the car dealers quite so much. That meant that the yield from the station in terms of revenue per hour listened was never going to be as high as Heart, but it was good enough for them to be relatively profitable, gave us a great platform for the growth of the business and justified then the investment we made in building our own national sales team, which we did, and that was very successful. And you could only do that with a certain degree of overall size, and Galaxy certainly gave us that size. Because we'd invested so much in Galaxy, it allowed us to win the license in the Northeast.
Hi, we're All Saints, and this is really cool. It's the Northeast newest radio station, Galaxy 105 and 106.
The great thing about Chrysalis was it was run by a man who believed in creativity, in Chris Wright. He therefore wanted the people who ran the businesses to be creative, not be driven first and foremost by pure commerciality. And I think that allowed us to have a great deal more scope. Richard ended up being the chief executive of the group, which is a very creative guy, but also is an absolutely brilliant businessman and comes from an accountancy background, so can drill down into the nuts and bolts. And therefore, you had both the numbers guy ensuring that this wasn't going to fall over and the creative guy wanting to know, were we doing the best traffic and travel we could? Were we playing the best songs? And why weren't we doing this very clever promotion? And Chris wanted to see what the posters looked like and would critique the posters. Now, there are times when that's a pain in the backside, but actually it's better than having somebody who doesn't know the first thing about creativity being part of the business. The first rule is hire the right people. The second rule is let them get on with it. The third rule is create the structure and the culture that allows everybody inside an organisation to give of their best. And there are things that you can do that, and there are things that if you do them, you won't get that. Always think about those things.
Galaxy 101, number one for dance and R&B.
We sold Galaxy 101 in Bristol to GWR, and in return they sold us LBC in London. There was some cash element to it as well. Ralph didn't end up being allowed to own Galaxy 101. The Competition Commission made him sell it on to somebody else. Ralph was always a man that thought two or three steps ahead, and he'd got a potential buyer in place in case he couldn't hold the license, so he did okay out of it. We ended up with LBC on AM and FM, and the attraction to us for doing that twofold. One was to strengthen our position in London. Previously, I think we'd made a mistake in not buying Magic and letting EMAP buy Magic, or certainly not putting up a big enough fight to try and get Magic. It was Melody at the time. So we felt we needed to strengthen our London presence. LBC was a completely different format and one that was going to be a challenge to run. But we had the great opportunity to flip the format. It was the end of a license period, and a new license period had just started. The radio authority had said, you can put the talk station back on FM and you can move the rolling news station onto AM. And the benefit of that was that the rolling news service only ever got very low average hours, 3 or 4 hours a week. Quite decent reach, but only very low average hours. The talk station, on the other hand, got stonking average hours, but because it was on AM, you couldn't convert that into revenue. So we had this great opportunity in this acquisition to do that flip and move the talk station back onto FM. where it is now. We had a sort of false year. We had a breakfast show with Jane Moore and John Nicholson, great double act, and it was a very didn't catch fire. Jane, I think she got pregnant, she had a baby. So we decided that we were just going to blow it up and start again and try and do something different. And Nick Ferrari had been on mid-mornings and had done fantastically well. And we thought, we're just going to have to take a punt here. And let's give Nick his head and put him on breakfast. And the rest is history.
What's the cost of a value sliced white bread loaf at Tesco or Sainsbury's this morning?
Well, it's going to cost you over a pound. I mean,
the LBC story was one of great growth, certainly in terms of audiences and certainly in terms of strengthening Chrysalis's position in London and its profile. In terms of profits, I don't think by the time we sold the business in 2007, I don't think there were any form of significant profits inside LBC. It may have been treading water, breaking even, but it wasn't doing any more than that. Getting LBC to profitability was something I had no idea it was going to be as hard as it turned out to be, to persuade people to buy advertising space on a radio station that pretty blooming successful. Persuading people that it wasn't just cabbies listening to LBC was a challenge that defeated me and Don. And when you compared, for example, the revenue that we were getting from a Heart versus the revenue from an LBC, when you were delivering pretty big audiences, the disparity in yield was quite remarkable. I'm still very proud of that radio station, and it's great to see that Nick Ferrari and James O'Brien, the two stalwarts who were there when we sold it, are still there today. And I think it's recognisably still the same radio station. I bloody well hope it's making a profit now. Chrysalis and GMG Radio. So I was great mates, as you know, with John Myers, had been for ages. And it was obvious to both of us that these two groups needed to merge. They had very complementary licenses in different parts of the country, would have been probably one of the easier mergers. I don't think any merger is easy because you've always got different cultures, but I think it would have been one of the easier ones. We'd been talking since 2003, 2004, and we'd gone around the houses a number of times. John and I had tried to get our respective bosses, in my case it was Chris and Richard. John's got the board of The Guardian. And we'd gotten close a couple of times, but we just couldn't quite get over the line. And then GMG Radio bought a couple of the big ones in Northwest and Northeast, I think, the two Centuries. At that time, I then said to the Chrysalis board, we have missed the boat here in terms of the other groups, the EMAPs, Capital Groups, GCAP, bigger than we are. So my advice is, times are good, revenues are solid, we're making lots of money, we should sell. I don't go back to my MBA very often explicitly and pick out something that I learnt, but I did then, because Jack Welch, the legendary CEO of General Electric, had a philosophy of life which was, in any market that you're in, and General Electric, of course, was in many, many, many markets, you're either first or second, or you get out. And we took that view to the board. And the challenge for us, we were not highly indebted, but we borrowed money against the value of the music publishing assets to buy more music publishing assets. So we got a pretty big music publishing catalogue, but we borrowed against it, so we couldn't borrow more money. Chris owned about 27% of the business, didn't want to dilute down and risk losing control, and one can understand that. That led to a sale process that ran through the beginning of 2007 and ended up with Global and Ashley buying us in the August of that year. I tried to be very professional. I recognised it was the right thing to do. We'd got to focus on selling the business. And so the difficulty for me was that Ashley was quite keen on me staying and being part of that team. And that was a difficult decision for me to wrestle with. Did I want to continue to be part of a bigger group but with less power? Or did I want to go off and do something else? And I eventually decided I wanted to go off and do something else. But that was a wrench. And obviously leaving Heart and LBC and Galaxy was a wrench because they've been part of my life for so long, and in particular in the case of Heart, that really was my baby. I still now think I made the right decision. But I do sometimes scratch my head and think, I wonder what would have happened if I'd have stayed. And it's interesting because Ashley has done, I think, a monumentally great job with the assets that he's bought. That would have meant I didn't do the other things I did. And I've enjoyed the things I've done since Chrysalis. So difficult. But we sold within weeks of Northern Rock going under and within 12 months of the entire Western financial system blowing up and asset values being half of what they were 12 months previously. So I did an interesting number of consulting gigs, busying myself in between. The first thing that happened was very shortly after we sold Chrysalis, EMAP put their radio and magazine assets up for sale. Global were looking at EMAP's radio assets as well as me. So I was looking, Global were looking, Bow were looking. And I pulled together a consortium of private equity backers and we bid £420 million for those assets. We were beaten by Bauer, hats off. Actually, they bid for both the radio and the magazines. We were never going to win a bid for the radio on its own. I don't think there was another bidder for the magazines on their own, where if you'd have added the magazine value and our radio value, it would have beaten Bauer's bid. So Bauer were the winners. That was a great learning experience for me. And it meant then that I also got involved with one of the same private equity firms looking at the Virgin vehicle, which came up for sale out of STV. Didn't do that. The Indians did that. We didn't get quite as far in that. I don't think we could make the numbers work. And I think not getting the Bauer assets spurred Global into their GCAP bid. I think they always wanted GCAP rather than EMAP. And of course, then out of that came the OFT review and the decision to sell the Midlands licenses, which then gave me the opportunity to try and put a private equity bid together for what became Orion. So all of these chains, they're all interlinked with each other, and that one in the end came good for me. So the stations we bought were BR&B in Birmingham, Beacon in Wolverhampton and Shropshire, Mercia in Coventry and Warwickshire, and Wyvern in Herefordshire and Worcestershire, and then what was at the time we bought it, Heart 106, the regional covering the East Midlands. So together they all covered about 6 million people. I wasn't confident at all of winning that bid. It was very, very challenging. A couple of things happened at the time. Over the course of the bidding process, the monthly revenue numbers were coming out and they got progressively worse. For a trade buyer, like a Bauer, for example, that's probably a concern, but not a critical concern. For a private equity-backed buyer, where the numbers are absolutely everything, that becomes more of a problem. So it was quite a tense period, and we had exclusivity, and then we lost exclusivity, and Bauer thought they were in, and we thought we were out, and then we thought we were back in. It was a very, very tense process, and you know, we snuck it at the end. I have to say, it was touch and go, and that was a great second burst of my career. Well, the first thing you feel when you acquire something is knackered, because the effort that goes into a corporate acquisition is unbelievable. Trust me, it is one of the most stressful points in your life. I think I lost a stone in weight during the course of that, the last 3 or 4 weeks of it, because it was so pressured. And then I felt fantastic about it, and there was a real degree of excitement. BR&B had moved since late 80s and early 90s when I'd been running BR&B and Extra. We'd been in the old radio house. After Capital had bought it, they moved it to Brindley Place. So I wasn't walking back through the front door that I walked through 20-odd years previously, if that the drift. So it did feel a bit different because it was in a different place. But it was still the same brand, and there were still people there who'd been there when I was there. Tom Ross was still hanging out, and other people. So that was great. But I was also very conscious that we'd bought the business with private equity money and those guys wanted a return, and that therefore we had to deliver a return for them. So I'm here for a while. I've got a job to do. We're almost certainly going to be selling this business in 3, 4, 5, 6 years. So I need to work hard to get it in the best position to sell. There were competing pressures. The stations in the West were knitted together to a degree and shared some programming and had very similar formats. They all had AM services as well. The big challenge, I think, in the West was that the stations had been in long-term decline. If you put a graph of their audience in 1999 versus 2009 when we took over, it just looked absolutely horrible. That we just knew that we had to do something to bring them back to the position that they should have been in. In the East, different issue. We could only ever have bought that business with the Heart brand in place because it was being sold by Global and Heart was a global brand. But it pretty soon became obvious to us, the Heart brand is brilliant. But for an owner who's got a brand that they don't own on their radio station, particularly when it's owned by Global, who were very ambitious, they were going to launch national digital versions of Heart. We were going to see an increasing move from Heart onto DAB. And in the end, you were potentially going to end up not owning the thing that you thought you'd bought. And that was the reason why we changed the brand to GEM, because we thought if we leave it as Heart, we're actually not going to end up with anything in 5, 6, 7 years' time. That was very tough. Right business decision, very, very difficult. It was the toughest decision I'd made. I felt horrible about it, in part because I felt we owed Global a proper duty of care because we bought it off them. And I had talked to Ashley about the challenge and he understood, but I don't think he thought there was anything he could do. And it just became a very difficult decision. And I hated doing something that would damage the Heart brand because it's a brand that I love. But it was the right thing to do for us. And actually, GEM has become this bloody great radio station. So in the end, that all worked out really well.
In just a few seconds' time, the new year of 2011 had also a new name for this radio station.
In the West, we had different issues. We had four local stations that were in different stages. Some were still doing okay. Wyvern and Mercy were doing okay. Beacon and BR&B less so. Global move to Capital Smooth Heart meant that they had all three of their brands in the UK's, arguably the UK's second market, and they were going to market the heck out of them. And they spent a lot of money on TV and support marketing and did a great job, but at our expense. And that was one of the reasons why we felt we needed to step up our own marketing, and one of the reasons why we looked at TV and came away thinking that just the TV thing just doesn't work, because half the money you spend, if you were marketing BR&B on TV, half the money you spend is wasted because it's going to people in Wolverhampton or Coventry. And if we spent money just on BR&B, we'd never spend any money on Mercia or Beacon, and they would suffer. So that was the genesis, if you like, of the maybe if we have a single brand that would work. And we obviously blew it all up and put Free Radio on there, and that didn't go as well as GEM. And I think we all felt massively frustrated that we had made a difficult situation more difficult at the time by putting a new brand on, which didn't immediately come back to the strength that it had had as those heritage stations. It came back over time. But again, there are certain decisions you make in life where you think, well, I wonder whether there would have been a different outcome if a different route had been taken. We really struggled with the name for a number of reasons. Radio stations traditionally have been very free and easy with names. People have gone and used a name and somebody else has used it somewhere else and they've gotten into a bit of a fist fight, but nothing much has ever come of it. And then during the last 10 years, brands have become so much more important that trying to get the right name means you've got to do the proper due diligence through checking with the copyright lawyers. And we went through a whole bunch of names, couldn't find one that worked. I think we got to the point with Free where we all liked it. We probably didn't focus group test it enough. And I think had we done that, we might have come back and thought, maybe there are some issues with Free that we haven't thought about. Now, I think it's a perfectly fine name and I don't think there's any problem with it. But at the time, it definitely didn't sit quite as well as I think we'd expected it to. We spent a lot of money on marketing Free. We had a great TV advert, the hamster advert, which certain people poo-pooed, but actually tested fantastically well and was very memorable. But the frustration was that the Rajar numbers didn't reflect what we felt on the ground, which was that we'd made a change, that we'd lost a few people, but that we were gaining people in return, and that we were actually pretty much where we should have been beforehand. And I think that just goes to show that certainly with Rajar Diaries, there is a degree to which brand value, brand presence, name recognition counts as much as the actual listening that you're getting as a radio station. You change brands at your peril.
set yourself free. Free Radio, today's best music mix.
We exited delivering a profit, a return for our shareholders, including some cash in my pocket and cash in the pockets of the other directors. Not as much money as we possibly had dreamt of when we started. I asked Adrian to take over as chief exec and run us through the final bit of the sale process, and he did a great job. You know, as all these things are, it's very tortuous doing a corporate acquisition or a corporate disposal, and I think Adrian probably aged 10 years doing that. But we all came away thinking that it was we'd done okay. We'd placed the licenses in a pretty decent home. I took my ill-gotten gains from a whole career spent in radio and spent some of it on doing up the villa that we owned in Mallorca with a view to renting that out and being a rental property owner. At the same time, we decided to, our kids had left home, and Jean and I decided we were going to have a change, move from the house that we owned out in the country and move into town. And we moved into Leamington and bought a derelict townhouse. Probably one of the more challenging things I've done in my life, probably on a par with launching a radio station, rebuilding, renovating a house. Very challenging. The goal was to not fade away, but not to do anything too dramatic. And then I get a phone call from a very old friend of mine, Paul Smith, from Cellador fame, to say that he would very much like me to come and join him on the board of that company. I spent a year and a half, I think, all told, trying to advise Paul on what the best thing to do with Cellador was, and I felt the best thing to do was to sell the business. And so we, 2018, embarked on a quite long process, actually, with Bauer of selling the business. We obviously talked to other radio groups, but Bauer were the people that came back and were obviously the ones that were most interested. So I decided to retire again from the radio business, thinking I'd already retired in 2016. And then 3-4 weeks after the disposal, I get a phone call from Peter Brimicombe at Bauer, who's the guy that we had sold the business to. And obviously Bauer had been doing multiple deals, and three of the four deals that they'd done were announced at the same time: Cellador, Lynx and Wireless Group. And they announced UKRD a few weeks later. A few days after the Competition and Markets Authority had decided that they wanted to investigate those acquisitions and to put those licenses into hold separate. And they said to me, would I go in on a consulting basis and effectively be like a non-executive chairman? I couldn't be, because they were obviously hold separate and they were part of Bauer. But I went in at that sort of level as a senior independent advisor. Only supposed to last 2-3 months. It was all supposed to be done and dusted by June, probably. It ended up being almost 15 months of me being this senior independent advisor to a hugely disparate set of radio groups run by four really great people in quite remarkable circumstances. I put it up there as one of the most interesting year and a bits of my career. Really, really very interesting. Could it have been resolved in June rather than going to phase two? I personally think it probably should have been. From a practical perspective, it's cost Bauer an awful lot of money in legal fees and in consultancy fees. Not me particularly, but the consultants that advise you on market dominance and all of the econometrics. The lost income that they've had from these groups for a year because they've not been able to integrate them. And also the massive, massive distraction for Bauer, I'm sure, in terms of the time that they've spent focused on this. But in principle, I'm very much in favour of organisations like the CMA having a lot of power. I think we live in a country that is run on a free market capitalist basis. And if you're going to be run on a free market basis, you better have a market supervisor that's got some teeth. I think the future of radio is a question that it's simply impossible to answer right now, in part because we are in the middle of this COVID-19 epidemic. Everybody's lives have been shaken up. Will we ever return to the same degree of rush hour driving that we had before? Probably to a certain degree, but maybe not to where it was. So will drive times become as important, breakfast shows as important as they are? radio has become a different sort of companion to people now than it was before. Podcasting is taking an increasing share, certainly of radio listening, speech radio listening rather. We're seeing new stations launching like Times Radio, which I hope is successful. Taking a long-term view, if I was Ashley or Dee or the people running Bauer and the people in America who are in a similar position, I'd be worried about Spotify more than perhaps many other people. I think they're gunning for the radio dollar. Certainly for Orion and Chrysalis, I meet lots of people who say that was the best time in their radio lives. I take great pleasure from that. I'm obviously going to be remembered as the guy that launched Heart, and so I should be, because that was the biggest thing that I've done. So, you know, on my tombstone it'll say, for good or ill, whether you love it or loathe it, Heart, you know, this guy brought it into being, and that was, you know, a tremendous point in time, and it's great to see it going from strength to strength.
Phil O'Reilly. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and if you do enjoy radio reminiscences, then do grab my book. It's called Radio Moments, looking back through my own eyes, very candidly, at what it's like being part of this crazy radio industry over the last five decades or so. That's called Radio Moments. There's another book on radio techniques, if that's more use to you. That's called Radio Secrets. Thank you.